Previously on Red Pilled America.
Wokeness has seeped into every crevice of American culture.
Ultimately, the Frankfurt School wanted to revamp Marxism to make it an agent of societal change.
These Marxist intellectuals needed to find their revolutionary energy elsewhere. They were on the hunt for new oppressed revolutionaries.
I charge the white man with being the greatest liar on earth.
And Mr. X early this morning met with Cuba's Fidel Castro.
The Frankfurt School was seeing revolutionary energy bubble up in various enclaves of America. But perhaps the most surprising space where this energy was taking root was on college campuses.
Where did wokeness come from? I'm Patrick Carelci.
And I'm Adriana Cortez.
And this is Red Pilled America, a storytelling show.
This is not another talk show covering the day's news. We are all about telling stories.
Stories Hollywood doesn't want you to hear.
Stories the media mocks. Stories about everyday Americans that the globalists ignore.
You could think of Red Pilled America as audio documentaries, and we promise only one thing. The truth.
Welcome to Red Pilled America.
We're at the second part of our series of episodes entitled Woke Army. You've probably heard part one, but if you haven't, stop and go back and listen from the beginning. We're looking for the answer to the question, where did wokeness come from? By telling the story of how an obscure group of German refugees started all this woke madness and what we need to do to stop it. So in part one, we learned that at the end of World War I, German Marxist intellectuals were expecting their country to experience a socialist revolution. As their prophet Karl Marx predicted, they believed communism was the inevitable outcome of capitalism. Once the working class proletariat realized the exploitative nature of the capitalist system, they'd rise up and overthrow it. At the end of World War I, a socialist uprising did indeed occur. But when it was all over, the German working class settled on a largely capitalist system. In the eyes of these Marxist intellectuals, this wasn't supposed to happen. So they organized a conference to address the issue. In 1923, that conference evolved into a permanent institution that came to be known as the Frankfurt School. Initially, its researchers took an orthodox approach to studying Marxism. They focused on economics. But in 1930, German philosopher and sociologist Max Horkheimer steered the Frankfurt School towards the social sciences to see how German culture influenced the population. Horkheimer felt that if they could understand how both culture and the economy influenced the German people, they could better devise a way for Marxism to spread throughout their country. In 1933, the Institute hired political philosopher Herbert Marcuse, but before Marcuse could start, the Nazi Party took control of Germany. The Frankfurt School intellectuals were largely Jewish, so they fled the country, eventually finding refuge at Columbia University in New York. Away from the iron fist of Hitler, they embarked on Horkheimer's grand vision, to find a way for Marxism to spread into Western societies that had been stubbornly resistant to communist revolution. In 1937, Horkheimer introduced his seminal critical theory, an approach to social philosophy that attempts to shift society towards Marxism. This shift occurs by critically tearing down the existing capitalist society through critique. The power of critical theory is that it introduced activism into academia. In 1944, Max Horkheimer and his Frankfurt School colleague Theodor Adorno authored Dialectic of Enlightenment, where they argued that the capitalist working class had been fooled into conformity through the mass cultural industries of film, radio, magazines, music, books, and the like. By the end of the 1950s, the Frankfurt School intellectuals were coalescing around the consensus that the working class no longer had the energy needed to trigger their socialist revolution. Their original proletariat was too busy enjoying the fruits of capitalism, so they went on a hunt to find their new oppressed revolutionaries. And Marcuse began to find them in odd corners of society. The black nationalists led by Malcolm X had a militant energy that found a kinship with Cuba's communist revolutionary Fidel Castro. The second wave feminist leaders like Betty Friedan were using socialist rhetoric, and rebellious college students began to show an openness to radicalism as well. These movements looked separate, but Marcuse found in them a common thread. They each had the energy necessary to spark a socialist revolution, and they all adopted the same simple idea, that they were being oppressed by a system of control created by the white man. These desperate movements were gaining followers, but it wasn't until the assassination of John F. Kennedy Jr. in 1963 that they really went into action. the horrible news was the trigger needed to start a socialist uprising in America. Herbert Marcuse saw the common thread throughout these outcast groups and used it to thread the needle in his seminal 1964 book, One Dimensional Man. In it, Marcuse argued that capitalism whittled down critical thinking, making man a one-dimensional creature unaware that he is a victim of a domination system. To overcome their victimhood, Marcuse argued that one has to have an awakening to this system of control. In other words, they had to go woke. Marcuse released One Dimensional Man in 1964, and it captured the hearts of revolutionary leaders everywhere. In July 1964, riots erupted in Harlem, the same borough that fawned over Fidel Castro and Malcolm X meeting just 4 years earlier. Harlem rioters chanted for Malcolm X. To some, the isolated chaos and destruction looked coordinated, but it was a protest just a few months later on a California college campus that would clearly signal a dark alliance that was forming in the shadows.
By the beginning of the 1964 school year, to an outsider, UC Berkeley looked like a traditional white bread university. But under its surface, the campus had already been infected with the revolutionary mindset. The faculty had welcomed the controversial Malcolm X to speak on campus, and there was a small group of graduate students in the social science and humanities departments that wanted to bring a certain brand of radical politics onto campus. At the time, however, advocating for political causes on UC Berkeley's campus was largely prohibited. These students wanted to change this rule, so they decided to push the situation. At the time, Berkeley students typically set up rows of tables at an entrance to the campus property near the social sciences department where they handed out information for a variety of on-campus activities. So, at the beginning of the 1964-1965 school year, these politically minded graduate students convinced others to join them in setting up tables at this same location to promote political causes. The school administration took the bait and told the students they had to stop. University of California President Clark Kerr explained UC Berkeley's response to the students' prohibited activity.
Told them they had to go back on the streets where they've been traditionally for this kind of activity. And they then took the position that we want to undertake these activities on campus property itself, and we said this is not possible.
The students responded like seasoned pros.
The effect of cutting this off is to stop political activity on this campus.
The team that started it all began to rally other student groups arguing that it was a violation of their First Amendment rights and convinced them to defy the school's prohibition on political activity by setting up tables again, but this time further within the campus. On October 1, 1964, they did just that, setting their grand plan in motion. Campus police approached one of the males sitting at the table, a young man named Jack Weinberg, and asked for his ID. He wouldn't produce one, so they began to arrest him for trespassing. But as they did, he surprisingly went limp. The campus police were a bit perplexed. They hadn't faced anything like this on this prestigious college campus. One went to fetch their vehicle to get it closer to the now limp student. He drove it up onto the campus. And as the officers dragged him to the car, almost like clockwork, students began to gather all around them, arguing that they'd have to arrest them all.
You can't just pick on one. You can't pick on one.
I am arresting.
Now you're either going to come with me or...
All of us. We arrest us all. We're all manning the table.
The officers eventually got Jack Weinberg into the squad car. But as they tried to drive away, Berkeley students surrounded their vehicle, blocking its passage and refusing to let it leave until the officers let him go. One hour turned to 2 hours, and the students wouldn't budge. As the hours began piling up, hundreds of students began camping out around the police car. One of the original instigators of this confrontation, a graduate student named Mario Savio, hopped on top of the vehicle and made some demands. First, the police had to stop the arrest of their comrade, and second,
we're asking that there be no restrictions on the content of speech, save those provided by the courts. And that's an enormous amount of freedom.
If the administration refused, Mauro Savio gave the school administration a public warning that they would be subjected to constant, embarrassing protest until the university submitted to their demands. This was unprecedented. The school had never seen anything like this before. They had no game plan and were completely unprepared for what happened next. Welcome back to Red Pilled America. So after Jack Weinberg was arrested and put in the campus police car, UC Berkeley students surrounded the vehicle and wouldn't let it drive away. A standoff ensued, and one of the organizers of the protest, Mauro Savio, made some demands. The school had to stop arresting their comrade and remove all restrictions of political speech on campus. The campus police refused Mauro Savio's demands, and a standoff ensued. As if it were scripted, media caught wind of the situation and began talking to the arrested student, Jack Weinberg, as he was still seated in the back of the squad car.
Well, I just did what any of my fellow students, or my fellows in all these organizations, would have done.
The now building group of protesters were being organized by the politically active students, and they wouldn't budge. Mauro Savio, the leader of the group making demands, began negotiations with the school administration. And after a 32-hour standoff with students refusing to leave, University of California President Dr. Clark Kerr emerged with an announcement.
Well, there's been an agreement signed. Yes, by the student groups and by me as president of the university, which has several points to it. The first point is that the student demonstrators shall desist from their illegal actions protesting university regulations. We've also agreed to set up a committee to examine the rules.
For the next few weeks, Mauro Savio and school officials negotiated hoping to reach a final agreement. But when the University of California president emerged again, he announced the suspension of Mauro Savio and eight other student protesters. That's when Mauro and his team stepped up their attack.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
He called for the immediate takeover of the administration building. The protest organizers went to work like seasoned professional agitators, corralling students into the building to stage a sit-in.
So the Bay Area civil rights movement in the stairwell over there. The door will be open for anyone who would like to leave, and you may leave at any time, but you may not get back into the building.
The administration and campus police appeared stunned, and again, completely unprepared for their action. With media crews now capturing the entire occupation, the campus police made an announcement.
I have an announcement. This assemblage has developed to such a point that the purpose and work of the university have been materially impaired.
Hundreds of officers entered the administration building and began arresting the protesters. Roughly 750 were hauled off to jail. The entire affair consumed the campus and the media, and it looked as if the leaders of the protest were just getting warmed up. As they sang and smiled their way through being dragged out of the building, the school administration looked shooketh. At every turn, student agitators were outmaneuvering them like master chess players. After 2 months of protest, there appeared to be no end in sight. So, the Academic Senate, made up of UC Berkeley's faculty, convened and took a vote. And shockingly, they overwhelmingly sided with the protesters. Mauro Savio and his comrades' suspensions were rescinded, and all charges were dropped. The student protesters gathered to await the final announcement.
Student rallies at the University of California at Berkeley over the past 2 months have become commonplace. But today's rally in front of Sproul Hall has taken on a different tone. Several thousand students have gathered for what has been billed as a victory celebration, a victory the students feel is assured as a result of yesterday's action by the Academic Senate.
After 2 months of relentless protesting, UC Berkeley's administration voted to remove all restrictions on political activity on campus. The graduate students that instigated the entire affair had achieved a near-complete victory, and the whole world took notice. When it was all over, the leader of the protest, Mario Savio, gave a victory speech, and his worldview sounded familiar.
It's been said that we've been revolutionaries and all this sort of thing. In a way, that's true. We've gone back to a traditional view of the university. The traditional view, the university is a community of scholars, of faculty and students, get together with complete honesty, who bring the hard light of free inquiry to bear upon important matters in the sciences, but also in the social sciences, the question of just what ought to be, not just what is.
Shortly after their win, Mario Savio took questions from the media.
Do you see this as an issue that will be affecting other campuses, or is this a specific problem in your own school?
No, I think that this will, in the near future, begin affecting other campuses.
How were they able to pull it off? How did these young students outmaneuver a seasoned university administration and police force? Well, the students that led this campaign were not your normal students. Some weren't students at all. Simply put, they were Marxists that were intellectually fueled by the ideas of the Frankfurt School. The entire Berkeley protest was branded as the beginning of the FSM, or the Free Speech Movement, but it was false advertising. A participant in the protest later confessed the true goal of their activism when he wrote, quote, "The claim that the free speech movement was fighting for free speech for all was always a charade. Within weeks of the free speech movement's founding, it became clear to the leadership that the struggle was really about clearing barriers to using the campus as a base for radical political activity," end quote. In other words, the entire Berkeley protest was a planned campaign, and it was planned by Marxists. The main ringleaders were part of a radical socialist group on campus. Here's one of the primary organizers, Bettina Apotheker, speaking shortly after the protest about her communist beliefs.
I think that the students on the campus respected the fact that I disclosed my membership in the Communist Party, and the fact that I did it, and the timing of it, the fact that I didn't do it at a time when it would have hurt the FSM or would have hurt the movement on the campus.
Bettina worked closely with the Communist Party USA. Her father was a Marxist historian and strategist for the party. She'd go on to work with Herbert Marcuse, but we'll go on to that later. The so-called student that went limp when arrested was not a student at all. Listen again to his interview while in the back of the squad car.
I just did what any of my fellow students, or my fellows in all these organizations.
Did you catch that? To a UC Berkeley student just walking up while he was being arrested, Jack Weinberg appeared to be one of them. But he wasn't. He was a Marxist, a former student that wanted to help create a base for political activism on the Berkeley campus. This group was inspired by Fidel Castro's Cuban Revolution. They coalesced around a Berkeley magazine called Root and Branch that carried fawning articles about the socialist revolutionary. These UC Berkeley students disagreed with the old Marxist left's beliefs that communism was an inevitable outcome of capitalism. Instead, they adopted the Frankfurt School's critical theory approach. They believed the socialist ideal would only come through activism, and there was no better place to get active than within the institution that teaches the future leaders of the country what it means to be American. So, they went to work and changed the rules of the university. Many of them, including both Jack Weinberg and Mario Savio, spent the summer before the protest working with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, a radical black activist organization that was led by this man.
We have to move to a position where we can feel strength and unity amongst each other from Watts to Harlem, where we won't ever be afraid. And the last thing we have to do is to build a power base so strong in this country that will bring them to their knees every time they mess with us.
That's Stokely Carmichael. When the Berkeley protest broke out in 1964, Stokely Carmichael was a relative unknown. He worked with organizing sit-ins in Mississippi. The famous Berkeley free speech protest wasn't spontaneous. It was coordinated. An alliance was quietly forming between college Marxists and black radicals, and Stokely Carmichael was a bridge between the two worlds.
Stokely was a graduate from Howard University, a historically black college. He got his start working with Martin Luther King Jr., organizing student sit-ins in the South. But by 1964, he started to venture away from MLK Jr.'s nonviolent approach, instead finding inspiration in Malcolm X, who took a much more aggressive stance to confrontation.
This afternoon, we want to talk about the ballot or the bullet. You do too much singing. Today, it's time to stop singing and start swinging.
Malcolm X was teaching a new generation of black activists to be more aggressive in getting what they want. And he even began adopting Marxist rhetoric.
You and I are living at a time when there's a revolution going on, a worldwide revolution. It goes beyond Mississippi. It goes beyond Alabama. It goes beyond Harlem. There's a worldwide revolution going on, and it's in two phases. Number one, what is it revolting against? The power structure. The American power structure? No. The French power structure? No. The English power structure? No. Then what power structure? An international Western power structure.
So when Malcolm X was killed in 1965, Stokely Carmichael picked up the baton where he left off. By the following year, Stokely was popularizing a rallying call.
We want black power! We want black power!
We want black power. Stokely Carmichael became the ringleader of what would come to be known as the Black Power Movement, and he was directly connected to the radicals at Berkeley. So much so that they asked him to speak at the university in October 1966. Ronald Reagan, a candidate for California governor, asked Stokely not to take the stage. He did anyway.
Thank you very much. Privilege and an honor to be in the white intellectual ghetto of the West. Now, we are engaged in a psychological struggle in this country, and that is whether or not black people will have the right to use the words they want to use without white people giving their sanction to it. And that we maintain, whether they like it or not, we're going to use the word black power and let them address themselves to that. But that we are not going to wait for white people to sanction black power. We're tired waiting. Every time black people move in this country, they're forced to defend their position before they move. It's time that the people who are supposed to be defending their position do that. That's white people. They ought to start defending themselves as to why they have oppressed and exploited us. And that is the real question, I think, facing the white activists today. Can they, in fact, begin to move into and tear down the institutions which have put it all in the trick bag that we've been into for the last 100 years.
While visiting the Bay Area for a speech, Stokely met with a new group of black militants that called themselves the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. Its leaders were two Merritt College students that were inspired by Karl Marx, Mao Zedong, Che Guevara, and Malcolm X. Stokely Carmichael linked his SNCC organization with the Black Panthers and would eventually gain the title of the Honorary Prime Minister of the Black Panthers. And it wasn't long before he connected with the intellectual godfather of this new forming alliance, Herbert Marcuse. By 1967, Herbert Marcuse was a professor at UC San Diego. He was a relative unknown to the general public, but he was reaching legendary status within the hardcore Marxist academic circles throughout the world. Aside from his book One Dimensional Man being a smash hit among Marxist revolutionaries, he'd recently penned an essay entitled Repressive Tolerance, and by doing so, he gave birth to the idea of cancel culture. In the essay, he wrote, quote, "I suggest in repressive tolerance the practice of discriminating tolerance in an inverse direction as a means of shifting the balance between right and left by restraining the liberty of the right, thus counteracting the pervasive inequality of freedom and strengthening the oppressed against the oppressor." He continued, quote, "Liberating tolerance, then, would mean intolerance against movements from the right and toleration of movements from the left," end quote. In essence, what Marcuse was arguing was that the new left should completely censor any movement coming from the right and should tolerate all movements coming from the left, even if they were violent. The newly forming leftist alliance loved the concept, and it made him the perfect featured speaker at a 1967 gathering across the pond. Marcuse, along with Stokely Carmichael, were asked to speak at a London conference entitled Congress of the Dialectics of Liberation and the Demystification of Violence. The gathering was a coming together of the two sides of the leftist factions around the globe, the ones that wanted a revolution through peace, and the other that wanted it by any means necessary, including violence.
Violence is, will always be necessary to tear away the shreds of myth and absurdity that we've been encased in since we were born.
Don't escalate the hostility. Don't escalate the anger.
It was a two-week Congress of Intellectuals in London. Black power people headed by Stokely Carmichael. The flower people represented by Allen Ginsberg. Political scientists and a host of sociologists and social psychologists from the U.S. and Britain. The common theme of the meeting was violence and revolution. The participants seemed to accept the picture of a world divided into two great political power blocks, with a third world, underdeveloped countries and underprivileged minority groups, being violently exploited by the two giants in such a way that their only relief from this exploitation is by violence.
Herbert Marcuse and Stokely Carmichael attended to give a justification for the violent side of the argument. At the time in the summer of 1967, violence was breaking out throughout America.
43 Americans died in these streets. 386 were injured. 477 buildings were damaged or destroyed.
The riots would come to be known as the Long Hot Summer of 1967. Over 150 riots were breaking out in Atlanta, Birmingham, Boston, Buffalo, Chicago, Cincinnati, Milwaukee, Minnesota, Newark, New York City, and many others. During the conference, riots were breaking out in Detroit.
As governor of the state of Michigan, I do hereby officially request the immediate deployment of federal troops into Michigan to assist state and local authorities in reestablishing law and order in the city of Detroit.
The city of Detroit was shut down.
Law and order have broken down in Detroit, Michigan. Pillage, looting, murder, and arson have nothing to do with civil rights.
Something like it happened in 76 American cities this summer.
I don't think it's right for my people to act the way that they're acting, because we're fighting one war now in Vietnam and we're losing as it is. So, I mean, why should we come back here and fight a war among ourselves?
This Dialectics of Liberation Congress was organized to address the rising violence, and an attendee accused Stokely Carmichael of stoking the fire.
Well, I want to ask him, this is my question, is since you became a so-called violent man, Stokely, since you started advocating black power, have you been arrested? Have you got a rifle? Have you gone down in the streets of Newark and sniped from the windows with all the kids who are starving?
Yeah, I was arrested before I came here for inciting a rifle. That's right, to kill a cop.
You don't want to stop white violence, do you? You don't want to stop it, do you?
You are the descendants of the violent society. Have you stopped it? Have you stopped it? Have you stopped it?
Herbert Marcuse was a man on the hunt for a socialist revolution. It wasn't hard to see that the energy being expressed among the black power militants and student radicals was where the action was at. He was welcomed at the Congress with open arms.
It's my great honor today to introduce to you one of the greatest thinkers of our age, Herbert Marcuse. Herbert Marcuse is a very modest man. He really doesn't believe he's very important at all. But I think every word he's written, I won't go through the catalogues of his works, Eros and Civilization, One-Dimensional Man, disproves the modesty that he protests. I think every sentence he utters today will also disprove that. I'd like to introduce to you Herbert Marcuse.
When he stepped to the stage, he started by mocking the flower side of the debate.
I'm very happy to see so many flowers here. And that is why I want to remind you that flowers by themselves have no power whatsoever other than the power of men and women who protect them and take care of them against aggression and destruction.
He went on to argue that the leaders of this new left movement needed to take the violent energy being expressed in capitalist countries and channeling it towards a socialist revolution.
But the ferment is there. The ground can and must be prepared. The mutilated consciousness and the mutilated instincts must be broken. and the sensitivity and the awareness of the new transcending antagonistic values, they are there. And they are there, they are here, precisely among the non-integrated, the still non-integrated social groups, and among those who, by virtue of their privileged position, can pierce the ideological and material veil of mass communication and indoctrination, namely the intelligentsia.
In the crowd was a young student of Herbert Marcuse's that wanted to follow in the professor's footsteps, and she'd turn out to be one of the key revolutionaries that would eventually help bring wokeness into the American mainstream. Welcome back to Red Pilled America. So in 1967, Stokely Carmichael of the Black Panthers and Herbert Marcuse connected at a London conference to argue for a socialist revolution in America by any means necessary, even violence. In the crowd was a young student of Herbert Marcuse's that wanted to follow in the professor's footsteps, and she'd turn out to be one of the key revolutionaries that would eventually help bring wokeness into the American mainstream. Enter Angela Davis.
Herbert Marcuse taught me that it was possible to be an academic and an activist, a scholar and a revolutionary.
Angela Davis was born in 1944, Birmingham, Alabama, to a bourgeois black family. She grew up around communist intellectuals and organizers. Her mother worked with the Southern Negro Youth Congress, a communist-affiliated group. In her youth, she got involved with Girl Scouts protests against racial segregation in her hometown, providing her first taste in political activism. By the time she reached her junior year of high school, she considered becoming a pediatrician, but knew that would keep her in the black bourgeois society structure that she wanted out of. She was recruited by the American Friends of Service Committee, a far-left group that funded black students from the South to attend schools in the North. She had an appreciation for music and theater, so at the age of 15, she decided to take the group up on their offer to attend school in New York City to be involved in the Big Apple's cultural universe. She lived with Reverend W.H. Mellish, who was a communist and attended a high school in Greenwich Village. She was recruited by a communist youth group called Advance. Then in the early 1960s, she took a scholarship to Brandeis College. It was there that she was introduced to Herbert Marcuse for the first time. She recalled their initial interaction.
I attended his lecture course when I was a first-year student, freshman. And I was drawn by the way he was able to put history and philosophy together in a context that allowed us to think about the future as history. And so I watched him from afar for a while.
Then a crisis hit America that opened her eyes to a new possibility.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
As the news broke, Angela Davis watched as Professor Herbert Marcuse took action on campus.
I can actually remember him speaking during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
It opened her eyes to the idea that becoming an academic didn't mean that you had to abandon activism. Her junior year, she spent some time studying in Europe, but by the time she returned for her senior year, Angela Davis decided that she wanted to follow in Herbert Marcuse's footsteps.
I was ready to move from French literature to philosophy, which French literature was my major. And I went to him and told him that I was really interested in studying philosophy, but I didn't know where to begin. And I hadn't had any formal training.
Marcuse saw something in the young lady. She was hungry, smart, attractive, and black with a big afro. Maybe he saw her as a potential intellectual revolutionary for the next generation. So, Marcuse agreed to teach her philosophy through private sessions.
he said, okay, well, let's spend the first semester doing an independent study, which will be an intensive engagement with the history of Western philosophy. So we started with the pre-Socratics, and I met with him a couple of times a week.
As an undergraduate, he asked her to take his graduate course.
And so by the time I finished that, I was hooked.
She graduated from Brandeis in 1965 and decided she wanted to continue her studies at the Frankfurt School, which had already reopened in Germany.
It was because of his influence that I decided to go to Germany and study with former colleagues of his, Theodor Adorno and Max Horkheim.
She studied at the Frankfurt School for 2 years and stayed in touch with Marcuse. Then in 1967, a movement burst onto the scene in the United States.
I'd like to make a statement now with this respect. Statement of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense on the Mulford Act now pending before the California legislature.
Stokely Carmichael's comrades in the Bay Area decided to occupy the California Capitol to protest the passage of a law that would prohibit the open carrying of firearms in the state. The Black Panthers had been intimidating police officers in their neighborhood of Oakland by carrying firearms to monitor their traffic stops. Ronald Reagan, who'd recently been elected as governor of California on a platform of law and order, supported the passage of the bill.
But I would think that some of the bills that have been suggested, such as not carrying a loaded weapon on a city street or in town, this might certainly be a good one. There is absolutely no reason why out on the street today a civilian should be carrying a loaded weapon.
So the Black Panthers staged a protest of the bill by carrying their firearms into the Capitol.
The Black Panther Party for Self-Defense calls upon the American people in general and the black people in particular to take full note of the racist California legislature, which is now considering legislation aimed at keeping the black people disarmed and powerless at the very same time that racist police agencies throughout the country are intensifying the terror, brutality, murder, and repression of black people. At the same time that the American government is waging a racist war of genocide in Vietnam, the concentration camps in which Japanese Americans were interned during World War II are being renovated and expanded. We are forced to conclude that these concentration camps are being prepared for black people who are determined to gain their freedom by any means necessary.
Pictures of the armed Panthers within the Capitol appeared in practically every English-speaking newspaper in the world. And these men looked cool, with black leather jackets, big afros, and attitude. Angela Davis saw the news of the incident while she was in Germany, and after one look at the Black Panther image, she knew she wanted to get involved with that militant group. She traveled to London in July of 1967 to hear the Black Panther's Stokely Carmichael speak with her former professor, Herbert Marcuse.
Then I returned to this country and studied with him in San Diego.
When Angela Davis arrived in California in 1967, the stage was set for Herbert Marcuse's new proletariat to erupt into action. The Black Power movement was attracting new members like flies to a heaping pile of shit. The sexual revolution was underway. The feminist movement was ripping off their bras to stick it to the white man. Socialist radicals had made inroads into universities like UC Berkeley. And now, even academia had Marxists like Herbert Marcuse infiltrating the hallowed halls of academia. If each of these factions could come together, they could produce a woke army with the kind of energy necessary to start a socialist revolution. And in the beginning of the 1967 school year, that's exactly what happened. Next time on Red Pilled America.
Recently, wherever they had a riot in Europe, they had the riots in Rome and Marcuse showed up. They had the riots in Paris when the French had to bring out the troops and the tanks. Marcuse was there. When they had the riots with the students in Berlin, Marcuse was there.
It began a year ago when the so-called free speech advocates, who in truth have no appreciation for freedom, were allowed to assault and humiliate the symbol of law and order, a policeman on the campus. And that was the moment when the ringleaders should have been taken by the scruff of the neck and thrown out of the university once and for all.
We're going to replace capitalism with socialism.
Now, I think that the real reason that they're firing me is not only because of my membership in the Communist Party, but because I have tried to involve myself as much as I could in the black liberation struggle in this country.
In America, supporters of the black liberation movements are stepping up the pressure in the campaign to free Angela Davis, the black philosophy lecturer and communist who is now facing a charge of murder in California.
Red Pilled America is an iHeartRadio original podcast. It's produced by me, Adriana Cortez, and Patrick Carelci for Inform Ventures. Thanks for listening.